Welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we prepare for Wonder Woman's big cinematic moment with a discussion of her origins in All-Star Comics number 8 and Wonder Woman number 1, as well as the graphic novel Wonder Woman, The True Amazon by Jill Thompson, all published by DC Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions. How good are these stories really, and do they belong in that body of great comic book works known as the comics canon? My name is Kevin Morrow.
And my name's Kurt Holman. Hola! Wonder Woman, you say hola. That used to be her kind of thing. Am I remembering that right?
You could be.
Maybe not. Anyway, well, I'm sorry if I'm wrong. But I have this memory of her, like, lassoing stuff, like, back when she was with the Justice League in, like, the 60s or 70s and saying, hola, I've got you with my magic lasso, you know. Because everyone had a thing, you know, so. Yeah.
So we're here today to discuss Wonder Woman because, as I mentioned, the Wonder Woman movie, the long-awaited Wonder Woman movie directed by Patty Jenkins, is coming out very soon.
I'll say that one of the best puns I've heard in recent years was someone talking about either the Wonder Woman movie or the experience of watching Batman v Superman with Gal Gadot playing Wonder Woman and using the phrase, waiting for Gadot. You know?
That is good. I'm very much looking forward to this. The trailers look good, and I think we've both mentioned before, she's one of the few good things about Batman v Superman.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see if she can, like, carry the movie on her own, but she definitely has sort of the on-screen presence. So, you know, we haven't seen it yet, so we'll find out, you know. But it's like, looks good, trailer's good, you know, high hopes, you know.
And it's funny, because Wonder Woman has had quite a few origins over the years, probably not more so than any other comics characters, but she's been re-examined a lot.
Yeah, and we've and there doesn't seem to be a definitive Wonder Woman story exactly. You know, like the way The Dark Knight is a definitive Batman story, The Dark Knight Returns, rather, even though it's like set in the future and is kind of crazy, but it's a real kind of iconic story. And there's not really, let's say, a Wonder Woman story. They're origin stories, but not like ones that seem to sum up the character in a quintessential sort of way. Yeah. So we kind of bookended this discussion with the actual origin story and one very recent that we think is a very compelling take on the character, basically.
Yeah, and I wonder how much a lot of this is to do with the fact that just a primarily male-dominated comics industry just hasn't been able to get a handle on the character for so long. Granted, she's been in publication a long time in one form or another, but you have things like in the late 60s, Denny O'Neill and Mike Sikorsky, I think, took away her powers and made her into a kind of contemporary, like, tough gal, Emma Peel type, you know, spy character, which created a bit of controversy at the time. Gloria Steinem even, like, spoke out against it at some point, if I remember correctly. You had, obviously, one of the biggest changes was George Perez's run, which was kind of a reboot after Crisis on Infinite Earths, obviously, which was the Secret Wars of its day.
Yeah, that's almost like kind of the reboot of the way the character, I think, people think of her since the 80s, basically. Yes. Yeah.
And you've had aborted media attempts in larger media, like the David E. Kelly TV series, the pilot that never aired from 2011, which the No Time for Heroics podcast dedicated an episode to that. They found it on YouTube or something. I can't remember. And it did not sound promising at all. So, so we said, well, let's, you know, in the lack of a definitive Wonder Woman story, just like kind of with Guardians of the Galaxy, let's just go back to the original source and then something more contemporary, that more modern, that also plays into those origins. And we picked this one because it's pretty interesting and pretty compelling, even though there are some other recent takes, too, that have their own pluses and minuses. So why don't we just dive in?
Sure.
I'll do the creators. For All-Star Comics number 8 and Wonder Woman number 1, written by William Moulton Marston as Charles Moulton, And the artist, I believe, is Harry G. Peter for both of these.
Yeah. And ironically, you got this off Comixology from the All-Star Comics number one, and I read it from a reprint book called Secret Origins of DC Comics and realized that what I was reading was Wonder Woman number one.
Right.
And there's some discrepancies. So I've got like a kind of an expanded version of the story.
Well,
so,
I've read Wonder Woman number one, just not as recently as you have. I think I used to have the same anthology that you have right there.
So I'll jump into the summary. During World War II, a mystery woman delivers injured intelligence officer Steve Trevor to a U.S. military hospital. She leaves behind a parchment that explains the origins of the Amazons, created by Aphrodite to be stronger than men. The Amazons live on Paradise Island, away from the world of men, where Queen Hippolyta made a daughter of clay named Diana, who came to life.
As a young woman, Diana rescues Steve from a plane crash. Aphrodite orders Queen Hippolyta to send the Amazons' strongest maiden to return Steve and help fight the war. A disguised Diana wins the Amazon's competition to leave the island. She captures a Japanese spy, drops Steve at the hospital, and appears to leave. At the end, Steve doesn't realize that Nurse Diana Prince is actually the Wonder Woman in disguise.
One of the things, kind of to kick off the discussion that I thought we would use to frame part of it is the, there's kind of a cliche about heroes that the Marvel Comics are about heroes and DC Comics are about gods. And I think that's kind of, particularly in the case of Wonder Woman's a good example, because not only does the character like connected, made to be connected to Greek mythology, she's kind of a stranger in a strange land. She's from this, like this mythological place basically. And when she's like in the world of men, she's out of place. You know, she doesn't, you know, and there's sort of a fish out of water quality, but also like a, you know, she calls out sexism and serves as a role model for women, but is kind of an alien because she's not used to like living among the things that we live with, you know? So sometimes I find her, even though I like Wonder Woman a lot, I've always enjoyed her, I don't necessarily find her as relatable as I do to other characters, like some of the Marvel superheroines we've talked about, or the way Superman grew up, you know, in Kansas, so he has like roots on like, you know, contemporary society, and Wonder Woman doesn't so much.
Yeah, and even though in certain iterations of the character, and I don't know if this extends all throughout, say, George Perez's run or the more or more recent things, even though she has the Diana Prince identity, it's not the same thing as Clark Kent, because she doesn't have that grounding, you know, growing up in Smallville and those kinds of things.
There's a saying that, you know, that Superman is in disguise when he's Clark Kent, but he grew up as Clark Kent, you know, and was, so it's, he's got kind of those two guises, you know, with Wonder Woman, you know, Diana Prince as a quote unquote human is just kind of a masquerade, you know, at least in most versions of the character.
No, and what you said is also true about Batman, that there's a strong case to be made, and many have, that Bruce Wayne is actually the disguise.
Yeah.
So what do we want to say about this actual origin itself?
Well, one thing that's kind of funny, I don't want to get into kind of the mythological part too much, but in kind of the prologue where they explain kind of the origin of the Amazons, there's a picture where it shows like Ares and Aphrodite, and he's saying like, "My men will rule with the sword," and Ares is saying, "My women will conquer men with love," and it's like, it's almost like an idea of like a kind of like a love-based heroine is sort of interesting as a contrast to a war-based one. But basically, in the third, like the men dominate the women through brute force immediately. So it doesn't really turn out that well for Aphrodite. And so she kind of has to make the Amazons by necessity and like embow them with like great strength, you know, which is, you know, cool and fine. And they're great characters, you know. And it occurred to me that this tells a version of the ninth labor of Hercules, in which, you know, Hercules got the girdle from Queen Hippolyta. It turns out kind of badly for Queen Hippolyta in those. And in this one, he like does, Hercules is kind of like the embodiment of like brute force and also the sort of male trickery, you know, and he like seduces her and then like steals it from her. And so the women, so the Amazons, formerly unstoppable, are enslaved. And then Hippolyta prays to the goddess, and she, you know, basically like, you know, lets them free themselves, but they're most wear their the wristbands as signs of their, you know, what's the line? As a symbol of the folly of submitting to male domination, you know. Yeah. So
it should be said that William Moulton, is it Moulton?
Moulton, I think.
Moulton Marston. Mm-hmm. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
That it should that image of submission shows up a lot. And part of his pitch for the character was the idea of submitting to a loving superior or deity rather than submitting to the classical version of male violence. Why you have to submit to anything.
Is
another question.
Yeah, I don't know. We're not really prepared to get into all of the dynamics with him, but there's a tradition of like in the comics that he did of Wonder Woman being like tied up or bound. And there's like a famous like panel of a story where Wonder Woman's like tied up and she has like these like bandages over her eyes to help immobilize her. And she can free herself, but she doesn't want to take the things off her eyes because she says, I'm like, my feminine vanity won't let me, you know, tear my eyelashes, you know, so, which is almost like I've seen like blogs that refer to that, you know, it's almost like the Luke Cage confronting Dr. Doom and wanting his $200, you know, like icon, you know, but so there's some problematic depictions of Wonder Woman, even in the beginning, but in this one, it doesn't really go there for the most part. And she's like strong and resourceful. And there's some things about Paradise Island that are a little surprising in it. Like there's technological science in it. Usually it's like this sort of Mount Olympus Island spa kind of place where they're just kind of reclining and hanging out in these, you know, temple type places. But Wonder Woman rescues Steve Trevor and takes her back to her laboratory, quote unquote. Wonder Woman's got a laboratory, and she makes like this healing ray that not only like saves him, but actually have brought him back to life, you know. So she's got this medical science know-how and seems to like fall in love with him at first sight almost, you know.
Yeah, and that part is a little kind of iffy for what's designed to be this ultimate avatar of female empowerment. You know, like, of course you have to bring a white male into it, and of course she falls in love with him. That's always struck me as a little, you know,
and it's like the only man she's ever seen. But I like the idea that she, you know, has this sort of scientific background, you know, that she can apply. So it's something that kind of doesn't get remembered as much in those parts of the character, you know. And then later they have the competition to, you know, to take him back, you know, so they say man's world a lot. So we'll just say like man's world, you know, and they have almost like an Olympic Games kind of thing, which include probably my favorite aspect of this, which is like sword fighting on giant kangaroo back, you know, and it's like the kangaroos, I think, are an underappreciated part of Wonder Woman's origins, you know.
So this ties into World War II. You have the Japanese spy. There's a lot of traditional kind of military war stuff that was popular at that time in the subplot. Doesn't feel like it adds a lot to me.
In the version I read, it's kind of just in just a few panels, basically, you know, it's like, because they have like a lot of with like the games and like there's wrestling and, you know, the jumping her, she like jumps out away from a lasso to avoid getting caught. And there's the, you do the bullets and bracelets where she defends herself, you know? And I like how it sort of shows that, you know, she has like defensive fighting as well as, you know, offensive fighting. And it's funny how like the Wonder Woman having a sword is kind of a contemporary mainstay of the character, which wasn't that way for a long time, but it's like, well, she's got the sword right here in the beginning, so it has actually roots in the origin, you know. But the war part is kind of shoehorned in, and they like she like takes Steve Trevor away and they kind of find the island where the Japanese spy is, and he looks kind of like a stereotype of a Japanese spy of the time, you know. So like, this is not the most woke comic I've ever seen, you know. And there's some parts that, even though she's like this great, strong, iconic female character, where there's some kind of sexism of the era still coming through, where she gets her like costume and it says like, there's one like, you know, well, like any young woman, she's got to try on her new clothes, you know. And there's a Amazon competitor named Fatsis, and there's this sort of, you know, implicit body shaming of her, you know, even though it's like, it's kind of nice to have like an Amazon who has a different body type than the other Amazons, frankly, you know. So yeah, so there, I don't have a lot else to say about this. I don't know if you do either, but I think I like how it gives all kind of the elements of the character all in one place. So, you know, and I like the character, and I imagine she seemed probably kind of radical compared to the depictions of women in comics at the time. She says, "I'm just a woman" at one point, although I think she means just in the sense that, you know, I'm just like any other woman and not I'm just a woman and therefore not as, you know, an equal to males, you know. But yeah, but it's the kind of story where it introduces the heroine, but doesn't really get a sense of how she's going to, you know, interact with Ned's world or what she's going to do in kind of the stories that come after this.
Well, I will say that All-Star Comics doesn't have the kangaroo fighting, sad to say.
You really got the short end of the stick, it sounds like.
Well, I don't have a whole lot more to say about this, so why don't we do the Reckoning a little later.
We'll do them back to back.
Yeah, and we'll just dive into a discussion of Wonder Woman, the True Amazon, and I'll start with the creative team. Obviously, writer and artist Jill Thompson, letterer Jason Arthur, associate editor Jessica Chen, and editor Jim Chadwick.
Yeah, I'm particularly glad we're doing a woman-created book, you know, for a Wonder Woman story. That was part of my agenda when we picked this out, you know, was to have that kind of representation. And I'm glad the book kind of lives up to that, basically. So starting my summary, once upon a time, the strong independent Amazons were attacked by male-dominated neighbors led by Hercules, and only by the intercession of Hera and Poseidon did they escape. They settled on Themyscira, where Queen Hippolyta, wanting a child, sang to a daughter she'd sculpt of sand every night. Her song so enchanted the gods that they brought the sculpture to life.
Named Diana, the princess grows up strong, intelligent, and spoiled rotten. As a young woman, she hears rumors of treasure and monsters on the island and resolves to catch them all, kind of like Pokemon. The Amazons all admire Diana's deeds, except for Alethea, the horse trainer, who remains polite but unimpressed with her.
Diana resolves to earn Alethea's favor by winning the games of the Commemoration of the Warriors. Worried that she may lose the final competition, Diana cheats in the chariot race by releasing her captive monsters as a distraction. Diana wins the race, but realizes that the monsters have run amok. A wounded competitor saves Diana from a two-headed creature, only to be killed. Diana is horrified to realize that the victim is Alethea.
Hippolyta confronts Diana with her dishonorable behavior and its terrible consequences, and says that the Amazons will judge her. After Alethea's funeral, Diana vows to undo her misdeeds and devote her life to saving others. The Amazons agree to spare Diana's life, but send her into exile from Themyscira until she redeems herself. Diana leaves, wearing the red, white, and blue armor of Alethea, the true Amazon.
One thing that's interesting is that I was looking at Jill Thompson's background, and she began her comics career with publishers like First Comics and I think Now Comics in the 80s, but became the artist of Wonder Woman in 1990. So that might have been her first, like, of the big two story companies, you know, her first one was Wonder Woman. So I guess this is kind of going back to that entry for her.
Yeah. So this is a completely different beast from what we know of Wonder Woman's origins from any medium or any version of the comic book. There's no Steve Trevor, you know, no invisible plane, and a fairly unlikable protagonist.
Yeah,
if that's even the right word for her here. I think it's a daring and interesting choice that we're kind of just shown, you know, I guess Wonder Woman's motivation for going out into the world and helping people, in that she has some wrongs to make up for.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, in some ways it's like a, almost a cliche redemption story where it's like a character has to have a tragic backstory so they can redeem them. It's kind of like, you know, you have to, like, any character, no matter how simple, has to have some kind of brooding thing, you know? But with Wonder Woman, it kind of adds a little dimension to her. I mean, this, I guess, isn't really a canonical version of the character. I guess we should say.
You know,
this is
regardless of whether it becomes canonical in terms of this discussion.
Exactly. You know, I'm canonical in the greater world. You know,
right.
But I like that. Apart from the men at the beginning, like Hercules and the various, you know, jerk sexist neighbors, that it's kind of an all female story, and her motivations aren't caused by men or the intrusions of the male world, you know, whether it's Steve Trevor or the war, but, you know, kind of what she did herself and her relationship to the Amazon. You know?
Yeah, that's a very good point. What we were saying about redemption, though, it feels a little incomplete to me because we don't actually see her redemption. Mm-hmm. So we don't see a full arc here. And granted, this is an origin story, but it's kind of like, it's similar to say seeing Bruce Wayne's origin story and it ending with him deciding to go off and travel the world for years to learn from all the masters to gain the skills he will need to.
Well, but I don't know if I would, I see what you mean, but she's like, she's already got all her skills and she's got her Wonder Woman suit, you know, and she's got her lasso and stuff. So she,
I'm thinking more that going out into the greater world part, sure. And also she's not eight.
Yeah. But it's definitely her like going off into the sunset and not what she finds when she gets there, you know.
Right. There's very little of what we actually know of the character to, you know, to connect to form that connective tissue, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
To bring this into alignment with the character that we know, other than the name and the place of origin and the costume.
Yeah. But I've got some that I've been thinking about, and it might be a little controversial. Because I was read a number of Wonder Woman stories like in preparation for doing an episode on it, and thought a lot about the character. And I kind of, and this is a little bit before I read this one, but I was had this feeling that Themyscira is kind of boring, you know. And like it's a place where like if I could go there, I would like to go, and I wouldn't be killed as a man, you know. I would enjoy it because it looks great, you know. Yeah. You could just go and chill for a month, you know. But it's not very dramatic and kind of bland in a way. Like I talked about kind of how it looks like the sort of the Greek spa kind of thing, and the characters are kind of all the same, you know. It's like they're like, you know, there's Diana and Hippolyta and the rest. And they all kind of blur together, partly because they're all, you know, beautiful, immortal warrior women. So they just kind of look together because that's how they're designed. But I was thinking about comparing that with like Asgard and how, but partly it's a little bit different because they're using actual mythology differently. But you think about like how Kirby designed Asgard with like, you know, and the characters in it where there's like Odin and the Warriors Three and Loki and Heimdall, you know, they've all got interesting looks and diverse personalities. And there's a lot of kind of drama and conflict kind of roiling in Asgard, no matter when Thor goes there. And Paradise Island or Themyscira, it's always kind of peaceful and a little static. And there might be one Amazon who's got a grudge or something like that, you know. So I was almost...
Yeah, there's not a lot of internal conflict.
Yeah.
And that reminds me a little bit of something I'm going to mention later on, which is Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang's run on Wonder Woman after DC's New 52 back in 2011 or so. Yeah. And in the first volume of that, they create some tension between Diana / Wonder Woman and some of the other Amazons, but it's still not like what you're talking about with Asgard, which is a very good example. There's not a lot of built-in soap opera elements there, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, and I also want to mention Asgard because this is kind of like a Thor story, and with like Thor needing to be worthy and prove himself kind of story. So it's kind of a lucky coincidence that we just did a Thor worthy story on our previous episode. But I was thinking about how, just in kind of Wonder Woman, the character in general, that it's like the Greek mythology doesn't really seem to work that well a lot. And maybe it's better if it leans away from them. And this book, it's kind of the opposite, where it like kind of leans into it and works really well for me. It's like, it's a lot more storybook and is literally like the Pandora story wrapped into the Wonder Woman origin. But it's like, I find very affecting, and it's a vision of Themyscira that makes a lot of sense for me, you know? So I kind of like took a little journey with the character that kind of culminated with reading this. And when it's like, well, this is kind of how Themyscira should be, I feel. And it's like, I don't know if Jill Thompson was thinking this, but it's like, you know, Wonder Woman is basically, or Diana is like the only child raised on an island that's like all women basically, or just all people. So she's like the only kid, and she's a princess, and she's got like superpowers. So it's like, well, Of course you would get spoiled, yeah. Rod. You need to be very careful to keep that from happening.
No, I think that's
you can see this playing out this way.
I think that's a very natural outgrowth of those things. I think that has to be conscious. But either way, it's very effective. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Even though, it's hard to know who to root for.
There's a series of panels where it's talking about how rude and willful she is, and it kind of goes in and like she's like crying or yelling, and she's got like her front teeth missing, so it's like a caricature of a spoiled little brat, and that doesn't really fit our vision of Wonder Woman, because the character as a grown up is not a spoiled person like Veronica from Betty and Veronica is, for example.
Sure.
You can see Veronica being like that kind of always, and Wonder Woman is a lot more grounded and, real. Real in the sense of, measured and dignified and,
So Wonder Woman's Betty is what you're saying.
Well, she's closer. Yeah.
Let's talk about Diana and Alethea a little bit. I'm not going to dance around it. There are some strong lesbian overtones here in Diana's increasing need to win Alethea's favor. The more that she kind of seems indifferent to her, the more Diana is resolved to win her affection.
Yeah.
And it's not spelled out.
Yeah.
But I think that that's not an accident either.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can read into it either way. I mean, part of the reason is like it might be a romantic thing, but it also, I think, works if it's just that, it's the one thing she wants that she can't get.
Yeah.
So given that she's like gotten everything she wanted all her life, you think that would just drive her crazy?
That's true too. But at the end, it's clear that she has, great affection for Alethea now that she, and we see more of that now that she knows that she's gone. This is something that Greg Rucka made pretty much explicitly text in his Wonder Woman Rebirth title from last year. And there was an interview on, I think it's called Comicosity, where he pretty much came out and said that, are we saying Diana has been in love with and had relationships with other women? As Nicola, who's the artist, and I approach it, the answer is obviously yes. And it needs to be yes for a number of reasons, but perhaps foremost among them is, if no, then she leaves Paradise only because of a potential romantic relationship with Steve Trevor, and that diminishes her character. Now, that's not at play here, because she leaves for a completely other reason that cannot, also works for why she leaves the island and becomes Wonder Woman. But I think that, it's the kind of thing that I'm sure it's the kind of conversation that I'm sure has been spawned in dorm rooms for decades, like on a island of only women. Mm-hmm. Of course you're going to have female relationships. Yeah. And I mean, I think that the way that Jill Thompson plays it here, she doesn't titillate with it. Mm-hmm. She doesn't, I hate to say throw it in her face, because it's not like, get that stuff away from me. It's understated, if not purposely, like you said, left completely vague. And I think that works for this story.
Yeah. I mean, it honestly didn't occur to me, even though it's like you said it, and it's like, well, of course, that's a perfectly valid interpretation. So, but one thing, before we, there's a part from before the Alethea thing where, I think it's the first time we see Diana as an adult. And, there's a part where the Amazons are kind of like gossiping after dinner, and one's a little drunk, and they're kind of talking about the monsters on the island, basically. And most of them are kind of, for lack of a better word, girlish and kind of nervous, which seems kind of strange if you think that these women have probably been are probably thousands of years old, but, there's monsters in this pool and we should stay away from there. And Diana's like, ha ha ha, I can't believe my warrior sisters who have fought 9 armies are afraid of a swimming hole. Tomorrow I'll dive deep into that water and bring up her bones. And she's like reclining on a thing, sitting up with like her elbow kind of cocked. And she looks like a female version of Hercules in a way, like kind of Hercules as that kind of, fists on his hips, chest sticking out. She's not quite in that pose, but it's like that kind of swaggering, cocksure, sort of, boastful kind of thing, which is kind of I kind of like that as a early iteration of Wonder Woman, you know, that, you know, stand aside, I'll being boastful and all that. And she kind of like solves all the monsters that way. But then when she's trying to win Alethea, she does all this kind of showing off. And Alethea's like, you know, I don't buy that for a second. And then she realizes that, you know, that it's almost like character is more than achievement or accomplishment. It's how you behave and comport yourself and how you treat other people. So that's when she starts learning this humility, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. And also I think that what you say about her character mm-hmm. and kind of boastfulness and mm-hmm. brashness is something that can be missing, I think mm-hmm. from her at times in various mm-hmm. stories in which Wonder Woman appears that I've read over the years. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of haughtiness and kind of, you know, like, an acceptance of the fact that she's pretty much a demigod.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking primarily of like, say, Grant Morrison's JLA mm-hmm. run, which you mentioned DC mm-hmm. Comics characters as being gods. And mm-hmm. that's pretty textual in there. Yeah. That he pretty much based them on like the Greek pantheon. Mm-hmm. But like, I'd like to see her have more traits in general, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, maybe she's a bit too cocky and brash sometimes, yeah. especially as a fish out of water mm-hmm. in a man's world. Oh, I got this.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It's like there's a great parts in the Thor movie gets kind of a bad rap, but there's that great fish out of water part in the middle of it where he's kind of swaggering around the town and like, you know, demanding coffee and walking to a pet store to buy a horse, you know, yeah. and someone says like, we just have like dogs and cats. It's like, well then give me one big enough to ride, you know? So, but I mean, I don't think, Wonder Woman is now should quite be like that, but she doesn't have a lot of consistent character traits like that are like, that are, you know, if not bad traits, but kind of colorful traits, you know, because yeah. she can come, almost come like a little too good to be true, you know? And yeah. so it's nice when there's a little bit of, you know, like Batman has this sort of intensity, you know, or something, you know.
And I will say that the Gal Gadot portrayal, mm-hmm. at least from what we've seen so far mm-hmm. at the time of this recording, mm-hmm. only being in Batman v Superman, mm-hmm. that there's an intriguing aspect to the character yeah. there, you know, a bit of a mystery to her, mm-hmm. Not just because the other characters don't know who she is,
yeah.
but because she's kind of purposely being a little coy with, mm-hmm. with Bruce Wayne in her interactions with him. And I'd like to see a little bit more of that, a little kind of spark and, you know, whether it's mischievous or whatever, like, you know, some personality that
yeah.
aside from just being, you know, a super strong, capable,
yeah.
badass, you know, demigod warrior woman, which don't get me wrong, all of that is great,
yeah.
but you know.
Well, it's like one thing that separates her from like She-Hulk, where Jennifer Walters is, she's like super strong and tall and all that, but she's also a lawyer and a woman in the big city, you know? So she's yeah. like, she's doing like work-life superhero balance is kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So that's the way that kind of makes her identifiable, you know, even though she doesn't have like a bad traits per se, you know, but it's like, oh, she's kind of dealing with the kind of things that most people have to deal with but also fighting Ultron or whatever,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, but to kind of get back to the true Amazon, we get into the competition scene where I like the parts where they're like doing the competitions and Wonder Woman gets kind of nervous. She's like, oh, well, this person's like almost as good as me. And, you know, it's like, it's almost like, because they're all in disguise. It's yeah. like, maybe people have been kind of letting her win, you know, yeah. all her life, you know. Maybe she's not as superior.
As she thought, she yeah.
might be I like that too. Slightly superior, but not as, you know, yeah. yeah. And kind of the action scenes are cool, and like the chariot race is exciting. And then, you know, she lets the monsters out.
Yeah,
you know? And that's it's one of my kind of notes on this. It's like you know, I can kind of see like letting one monster out. You know,
yeah.
letting them all out seems like, well, what would you think happened? This would be a horrible disaster. So I almost wish it had been like, she tried to let one out and by mistake, they all got out.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a sticking point for me too yeah. with the story. I remember the first time I read it, I was like, really?
Yeah. yeah.
but I will say that I do like the aftermath of that.
Yeah.
I do like that we see the horrific consequences of those actions, and that she is faced with them.
Yeah,
and you see like the maimed and scarred women who are like calling for revenge.
Yeah,
you know, and I don't. All right, maybe not you, but I'm thinking. I mean, you know, I don't want her to die, but they kind of have a point.
Yeah. You
know, like an eye for an eye.
She's, to quote a line from a old Nixon-era Doonesbury cartoon, she's guilty, 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 you know. But yeah, and also just comic books in general not showing consequences of violence, you know. Like, this shows, like, this person got dragged and her face got messed up.
Yeah.
And this one got her legs crushed.
Yeah.
And this one got brain damage, you know. And then not only do we kind of see it, and it's, you know, very horrible. And then she's like, and you're responsible and we're calling you onto account on it, you know? So,
oh yeah. And Alethea died.
And you know, most of all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so and the death is bad, but kind of the other things kind of leading up to it, it's like, you kind of really feel this weight. So, the tragedy really has a punch, where in a lot of comics, like the motivating tragedy can just feel like, well, they've got to have this thing to sort of like Uncle Ben being shot, you know, it's like, it's in Spider-Man. It's a lot of times it's sad, but it's like, well, you know, what's happening, and it kind of goes and move on. And it's like,
and Bruce Wayne's parents too, like, and those things kind of become an abstraction.
Yeah.
And Alethea's death could be that too. Mm-hmm. But seeing these still living people.
Yes.
And what they have to, mm-hmm. you know, what they're stuck with now, mm-hmm. and the pain and suffering that they've gone through.
Yeah.
Actually lends it a bit more weight, I think, than if it just been, oh, you know, your friend is dead. How sad.
Yeah.
Because in our culture, you know, movies, TV, video games, and everything, we're a little desensitized to death at times, at least in these portrayals.
Yeah.
When you see hundreds of people dying in, you know, like the Avengers or Man of Steel or whatever, you know, it's hard not to just have that be an abstraction. This makes it very real.
Yeah, like seeing like one person get her legs crushed is kind of more affecting than city destroyed or something.
And the scarred woman, that was very affecting.
Yeah. One thing I don't want to overlook this, but the facial expressions and kind of just how she designs the features in this is kind of interesting, and kind of the body acting. And one of the things about the original story is the William Marston story is that Wonder Woman was featured to kind of petite, and they seem almost like the cartooning of women in like the 30s and 40s, like comic strips and Betty Boop almost, you know? And one of them is kind of features are kind of big in this.
Yeah.
And it might be just the nature of the art that's done in this, but it also kind of makes her like more like a real person and not like they're trying to do this kind of feminine ideal. And it seems almost like a contrast to the original.
And even though, you know, she's born from clay, you know, like, she definitely looks like a person with some Greek blood in her veins, you know, and the huge curls of hair. I like that a lot. Yeah.
And I was thinking like some of the body acting strikes me. This might be me reading into it, but it reminded me a little bit of, one of like Greek theater, where there'll be like these pointing with the arms sticking out, you know, and like a face turning away in a mask of grief, you know, and like, and there are lots of masks in this, you know, so it's like the Greek theater wasn't masks. So it's like, I wonder if that's an influence here too. If it wasn't intentional, it's an interesting coincidence, I think, you know, but so it kind of, you relate to the characters in a different way than you do in a lot of comic books, you know, just because it's got that kind of demonstrativeness.
Yeah. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about, and this can lead into the reckoning for this, is the artwork. I unabashedly love Jill Thompson's painted artwork in here. It's beautiful. The colors are vibrant. The action scenes, like I mentioned, and even the scenes that are more sedate and seeing Diana, you know, as a child, you know, growing up and being a holy terror to all these other Amazons who have to, you know, like clean up in her wake. Just the facial expressions, the level of detail. It's gorgeous.
I agree completely. I kind of talked about, you know, contrasting the two, you know, cartooning styles and all that. So I don't think I have anything, but I like the use of color in it too, and how it's, it contrasts with kind of the white Grecian column vision of Themyscira that we see a lot. And it's just sort of different than, like, because it's painted like we see in usual comic books, which is exciting, you know.
Right.
One of my other notes is just getting back to the kangaroos. It's like, I think Alethea should be in the kangaroo stables and not horse stables, just because, you know, I think a missed opportunity, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I'm ready to do the reckoning if you are.
Yeah. Let's render a reckoning on both of these.
Okay. So,
or all three, as the case may be.
Okay. So, like we say, when we do the reckoning, we try and decide whether the book should have the artistic excellence, the lasting influence, and or that X factor to make them irresistible and make them worthy of the comics canon. And our vote needs to be unanimous. And we'll do the original story first. And I'll go first, and I'll say, I'm not going to vote against this. I really like this as an introduction to Wonder Woman, even though it's dated in a lot of ways. We could go through and point out the dated things a lot, but in terms of like the lasting influence, I'm not going to say no to this because I like the character and I think it strikes me as a very unusual, almost Flash Gordon-y kind of story, at least the one I read.
Yeah.
So I'm voting yes.
I will say that All-Star, the story introducing Wonder Woman in All-Star Comics number 8 doesn't do a lot for me. Mm-hmm. It's not really a full story because it ends at the contest and yeah. her going off to Man's World. You see Steve Trevor's plane crash. You don't even see him yet. Not that that's a requirement for canonhood.
You're mad there wasn't a man in there.
By golly. Yeah, no. So that I'm going to say no, but I'm not going to disagree with you about Wonder Woman number 1. Yes, absolutely. Wonder Woman, All-Star Comics number 8, I'm going to say no, not so much. And you didn't read that for this one.
No.
Anyway, as it turns out. But Wonder Woman number 1, it would kind of be like going against Action Comics number 1, which... you could point out, you know how different it is from what we're familiar with today, but it feels a little heretical too. Yeah, so yeah. So now to the true Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And why don't you go? Yeah.
Put me on the spot. So there's a lot I like about it. There's a lot that I wish was different, and that's just me. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much that speaks to its canonicity. Mm-hmm. I love the art, as I said. I kind of wish that we saw a little bit more of Wonder Woman herself rather than Diana just putting the mantle on. But this is really engaging, and, you know, it's a far less problematic read than, say, Grant Morrison's Wonder Woman Earth One graphic novel. With
Yeah, that's one of the ones I looked at. Yeah,
we both looked at that, and... that really leans heavily into the Marston bondage elements in some ways that are, we'll say, interesting.
Yeah.
So like it doesn't have any kind of problematic elements like that. I want to give it a more unqualified yes, but I'll say yes to this as well.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, I mean, because I'm yes too. So, so hooray, these are both canon works, you know. I would like to see like another version, a book two of this and a continuation of this, frankly, you know.
Yeah, that would make me feel a lot better, you know, and weighing in on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And we talked about that with our Black Panther episode, that it felt a little odd because we were very obviously commenting on, passing judgment on a story that had not finished yet.
Yeah.
And maybe not, you know, more unfinished than this, but still... Similarly, like you're like, okay, but how does it really wrap up? How does the, you know, we don't see Diana's full character arc here. Yeah. We see what has driven her to go off and join Man's World, but like there's a difference between that and being Wonder Woman.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't agree 100% because there's like some chapters of her becoming like the superhero we know that are familiar with, you know, but I feel like her leaving is kind of a very natural end for this particular story. So it's almost, to take a very serious example, it's like Oedipus Rex, you know, he finds out about his origins, blinds himself, and ends with him leaving, you know, his home, you know, so. I mean, I think Oedipus at Colonus has kind of the culmination of that, you know, but so it's kind of like the tragic conclusion, and she kind of, you must go off and redeem yourself. So it's like, you know, it's a really nice origin story. Now, my only kind of question is the fact that it's like, it's a little hard to square this version of Diana with the one that we know, you know, even though she's like changes a lot and is like trying to be a different person, but you know, this doesn't, the one we know doesn't seem like someone who would have this in her background, but
right. It's like, yeah. I said earlier, I'd like to see the, you know, the connective tissue that joins this character with the one that you're talking about.
Yeah. But so I think it's a great book, and it's very different from the ones that we usually do. And I was kind of like, phew, it's nice to get a new Wonder Woman story by a woman that I think is really good.
Yeah. And it's not, as you might've mentioned, it's not the canonical Wonder Woman. It's certainly not a definitive Wonder Woman story, but it's really good, and it's worth checking out. So congratulations to Wonder Woman number one, and also Wonder Woman, the True Amazon, for being inducted into the comics canon.
Hooray, huzzah. Yes, I got a classic comics ad for this issue. I won't read all of it because it's a little long, but I'll read parts of it. I mean, it's you might notice a thematic appropriateness to it. And it has a young woman standing kind of with their hands kind of like in a look here gesture. And there's some like young men looking admiringly in the background. And it says, "Be lovelier than ever in a twinkling with this two-way stretch all nylon girdle. You can't imagine how alluring you will look until you actually slip into one of these amazingly smooth DuPont nylon girdles." It's like smooth is stretched out and nylon is all caps. So it's like, you can't, I don't know if you should do more than one emphasis in a sentence. "They're so comfortable you won't know you're wearing one. It clings to you as though you were born in one. Five famous features: DuPont nylon, dries in a jiffy, priced low, guaranteed non-shrinking, four color rich shades. Style in your choice of four exciting shades: nude, blue, and glamorous alluring black. The greatest girdle buy in America." So,
might I point out that those are only three shades?
But well, nude, blue, white, and black.
Oh, white. Okay. Yeah. Never mind.
Did I say white? Okay. Well, white's in there, you know. Yeah. So anyway, so comics ads aren't always, you know, like war toys, basically.
All right. I don't think I'm going to buy that, but I don't think it will work with my figure. But let's move on into what we're still for now calling Cannon Fodder, which is our letters column segment. We've gotten a few reviews recently, and I'll not going to read them all today. We'll spread them out over the next couple episodes, and hopefully we'll get some more. Please write in, and we'll tell you how to do that later on. First, a SoundCloud comment that we got on our Court of Owls episode with Glenn Weldon from a few months back, from Owl Corp. "The Court of Owls was my inspiration for wearing the owl mask, rapping with my stage name Owl Corp." Another one.
I'm kind of, it's a code that kind of raises more questions than it answers, you know.
Yeah. So, and the other one I want to read for this episode: "Great podcast. 5-star review by John Fitter, who also happen to know follows us on Twitter. This is an enjoyable podcast with an interesting evergreen format. The two hosts summarize and discuss a notable storyline and together decide whether the work qualifies for induction into their comic book canon. Recommendations of closely or more loosely associated works are provided at the end. Although I don't always agree with their canon decisions, spoiler, Born Again and Dark Knight Returns, not qualifying, the hosts provide reasoned arguments for their decisions. I've listened to all past episodes and enjoyed them. A welcome addition to my podcast canon." So thank you very much, John Fitter. We really appreciate that. We really do greatly appreciate all the feedback that we get, because we just kind of do this in a room and send it out into the world.
It's like, when I know that people have like listened to it, people have listened to like all or most of the episodes. I'm like, really?
No,
like, and thanks.
That's very gratifying. Mm. And we're really glad to hear that. So there'll be more next episode, but for now we'll move into the spinner rack, which is our recommendation segment, where we talk about books that may or may not be related to the main stories that we've talked about in this episode. And I think in this case, they will bear some association.
Okay.
Why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, mine mine are connected through Jill Thompson. And as an artist, because I didn't really have a Wonder Woman book that I wanted to recommend 100%. One is Magic Trixie and the kind of the following Magic Trixie books. And they're for kids. They're like very fun, cute, kid-oriented books about like a girl who's like basically a young witch. And she's got kind of like kindergarten age, maybe a little older, maybe elementary school. And she's got friends who are kind of like monsters. So it's very fun and playful. It's kind of like a kid version of like the Addams Family or the Bo Jeffrey saga. So if you've got like a very young person or you like Jill Thompson's work a lot, you might want to seek it out. It's very enjoyable. And also kind of wanted to mention and recommend that she did the art for Brief Lives, the Sandman collection, like one of the longer and kind of more portentous, eventful Sandman collections. Does a bang up job on that, especially with the character of Delirium in that. So to follow Jill Thompson's work, those are very good examples, I think.
Cool. Yeah, and that is a great story. So if you're interested in other kind of Wonder Woman stories, I can't say I recommend Grant Morrison's Wonder Woman Earth One without reservation, but it's interesting. And if you are, you know, a Wonder Woman completist, it's certainly worth a look. Wonder Woman Year One and also Wonder Woman The Lies, both by Greg Rucka with Nicola Scott and Liam Sharp as the different artists on those. Also, The Legend of Wonder Woman by Renee DeLiz, which we had briefly considered for this episode as well. I'm not going to say that I recommend all of those, but they're worth looking into if you're looking for, you know, more Wonder Woman, you know, stories. The two books I am going to recommend, one is Wonder Woman Blood by Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang, which I mentioned earlier. Not an origin story, but one that throws a wrinkle, a kind of retcon into her accepted origin, namely that she is, in fact, the child of Zeus, which complicates Olympian politics quite a bit. And we were talking earlier about, you know, Themyscira could use a little bit more kind of infighting and things like that. You definitely, you know, get some of that with not Themyscira, but with the Greek gods, you know, and their modern day versions, at least, which are also very interestingly portrayed.
I've read that for this and thinking about talking about it and thought about making it my recommendation. Not crazy about the dialogue in it. And that ended up being kind of a barrier, but I thought that its vision of monsters and how the Greek gods kind of interacted with like contemporary society and how they were designed was interesting. It was a good, they were like good, like foils for Wonder Woman and a good kind of context for her. Yeah. It didn't quite sell me 100%, but I love the covers on those.
No, the artwork is great. I'm not going to disagree with you. And also like, you don't get a lot of sense of Wonder Woman as a character in that, but some of the other characters and the concepts that Azzarello plays with, I like those enough that out of all these, like, that's the one I would recommend first.
It's on a good track, I would say.
I'm also going to recommend The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore that came out a couple years ago, which is a great and very thorough look at the character and William Moulton Marston. Say that five times fast. write it on the chalkboard. You know, the creator of Wonder Woman, who also famously created the
he apparently created the systolic blood pressure test, which is part of the lie detector test. So some people question whether how close a line you should draw between the systolic blood pressure test and the lasso of truth. You know, some people say it's like maybe you shouldn't read too much into that. You know, but he had a hand in the lie detector and created like the Wonder Woman lie detector. So you know.
And Marston had a very interesting life and was in a polyamorous relationship with his wife and a mistress, both of whom had some role to play in the birth of Wonder Woman. But it's a really good, interesting look at the background and the influence of the character.
I guess all that we have left is to talk about what we're doing next time. And one thing that you had mentioned to me is that as kind of a lead into the discussion is that we did our Ghost World episode a few months ago, inspired by the movie Wilson. And we talked about Ghost World and Wilson. And that's basically become our most popular episode.
Oh, yeah, by leaps and bounds. Yeah. It had previously been Batman: The Dark Knight Returns, mm-hmm. but Ghost World has outpaced that by probably like 100 listens/downloads at this point.
And so in talking about that, there might be a lot of reasons for that, but that made us kind of think that like maybe even though superheroes are very big properties now, and that's kind of inspired a lot of the stuff we discuss on the show, we should kind of maybe branch out a little bit further, since obviously Ghost World, not superhero oriented. So, and we thought like, okay, well, what were some other things we might want to bring in? And things that we were thinking about doing anyway, but it's like, well, maybe we should, you know, put them a little bit, bring them a little bit closer from the back burner, I guess, you know?
I mean, and it's not the first time we had discussed an independent comic either. We talked about the graphic novel Fun Home last year.
Yes, yeah. Then there's some of them which are technically superhero that kind of blur, I think, the lines, you know. But all this to say is that the next time we're going to talk about Scott Pilgrim, and specifically the books Scott Pilgrim's Precious Little Life and Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which are like the number one and number two of like the Scott Pilgrim story. Basically, we were inspired because Edgar Wright, who directed the movie Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, has a movie called Baby Driver coming out at the end of June. And so even though Baby Driver had nothing to do with comics, but it's like, let's just use that as a reason to do Scott Pilgrim. So that's why we're doing it. You know?
Kurt throws back the curtain.
I'm parting the kimono.
To show you the inner workings of our decision-making process.
So, meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com. And the Comics Canon is presented with the support of Creative Loafing Atlanta, home of such podcasts as Mo Audio and Dish on the Dish.
And, dear readers, we'd like to hear from you. Rate and review the show on iTunes like John Fitter did. You can also email us at letters@comicscanon.com. You could post a comment on our Facebook page or hit us up on Twitter @TheComicsCanon. Let us know if there are stories you would like to see us consider or do for the podcast, and we'll read your correspondence in a future episode. I also encourage you to visit comicscanon.com, where you can read our show notes, which also include links to some of the, you know,
all the dumb ephemera we talk about during the show.
Well, I was going to say, you know, links that give more detail to some of the things we talk about. But yeah, your way works too. This podcast was produced by Grayson Bergman for the Comics Canon. I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Hallman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with Scott Pilgrim.